Last week, people across the country celebrated Juneteenth, which commemorates the day in 1865 when the news was finally delivered to Galveston, Texas, that slavery in the United States had been abolished 2 years earlier.
Here in Brooklyn, to commemorate Juneteenth, there were marches against police brutality and celebrations of Black culture.
And the steps of our central library were once again the site of demonstration and action.
On the morning of June 19th, Brooklynites spread out across the plaza in masks to listen to a youth drumming group and other performances from young people.
The borough president, along with city council members Lori Cumbo and Farrah Lewis, gave speeches about the importance of the day and the need to continue the fight against white supremacy in this country. Here's a bit of the speech that Borough President Eric Adams gave.
This is saying once and for all, the real issue of emancipation must come into a realization in this country. And if we don't get it right, racism is built and hardwired in the DNA of the American experience. And if we don't change the rewiring of that brain and every system of government, then we just went through a frivolous exercise, and like hell are we gonna allow that to happen. So this is what Black Lives mean. It means every institution, every organization, every agency, every individual. It's just not a fleeting moment. And that is what this fight is about.
Juneteenth this year comes at a time when the nation, and Brooklyn in particular, is continuing to reckon with racism and police brutality. As Eric Adams said, it's a time for all organizations and individuals to question their role in perpetuating structural racism.
We're going to be digging more into the library's role in reckoning with race as an institution in an upcoming episode. But for now, we'd like to return to an episode that we produced back in October for the 400th anniversary of 1619, the year when enslaved Africans first arrived in the United States.
Adjoa, I think it's true that too often we put conversations about racial injustice in another place, right? We might say slavery happened in the South, segregation was in the South. That's not our story.
Right, but it is our story. Ever since European settlement, when the land we now call Brooklyn was taken from the Lenape people, racism and slavery has been integral to the development of our city.
So today, in honor of Juneteenth 2020, we are returning to an episode we called Free Brooklyn. This is a story about our borough's relationship with slavery and the long struggle for freedom right here in Brooklyn.
I'm Adra Aduse.
And I'm Krissa Corbett-Kavoris. You're listening to Borrowed.
If you actually look at Brooklyn, I think the story of both injustice and justice that it tells is both fascinating, but also makes it a crucial reason that it needs to be on the map.
This is Preeti Kanakamadala. She's an associate professor of history at Bronx Community College of the City of New York.
A scholar in the 70s called this a slaveholding capital, and he was referring to Kings County. 1 in 3 Brooklynites were enslaved. So I do think there is a great deal of dialogue that needs to happen here in Brooklyn.
All right, so let's talk about it. We are getting into Brooklyn's own relationship with slavery and the fight for freedom. And this first story might be pretty surprising. It starts in 1860 when a 9-year-old girl named Sally Maria Diggs came to Brooklyn. What happened to her here would be documented in newspaper stories and memorialized in paintings and statues for decades to come. But who exactly was Sally Maria Diggs?
Krista and I wanted that question answered, so we talked to Natiba Guy Clement, the manager of special collections at the Brooklyn Public Library.
Sally Maria Diggs was an enslaved girl who was auctioned at Plymouth Church in 1860 when she was 9 years old.
That's right, auctioned in Brooklyn. Sally was enslaved in Maryland, and she traveled north in the hopes that enough money could be raised to purchase her freedom. Sally's family sought the help of Brooklyn's Plymouth Church and its famous reverend, a man named Henry Ward Beecher.
Henry Ward Beecher, he would do these sermons where he would auction, usually it would be young women or girls, auction them out of slavery. He would all often lead up to them with some really like fiery speeches about the dangers and the horrors of enslavement to kind of get his congregation to react.
This is 1860. Slavery was abolished in New York State in 1827, but Sally was still enslaved in another state. So the stakes of the performance were very real. If the congregation didn't raise enough money, Sally might remain enslaved and separated from the rest of her family.
When this 9-year-old girl stood in front of the church next to the towering Reverend Beecher, the congregation was up in arms. They donated over $1,000 to purchase her freedom. A famous poet in the audience even put her opal ring into the collection plate.
When Beecher saw the ring, he used it as a dramatic opportunity. He put the ring on Sally's finger in front of the church and, quote, wed her to freedom.
That's how the newspaper covered it, that she was wed to freedom. And he renamed her Rose after Rose Terry, who was the poet who was in the congregation on that day. And he gave her the name Ward, which was his name. So that's how she became Rose Ward instead of being Sally Maria Diggs.
Not only did Beecher rename her, Rose Ward became a sensation in the newspapers, where she was nicknamed Pinky because of her lighter complexion, a loaded term, especially because Beecher chose only women and girls with lighter skin to, quote, auction to freedom.
A number of scholars have written about this and said, you know, it was to appeal to a largely white congregation.
Here's Prithi Kanakamadala again. We talked to her outside of Plymouth Church in Brooklyn Heights, next to a statue of Beecher with two women crouched at his feet.
You know, Henry Ward Beecher says it himself, imagine your daughters or your sisters. And in order to imagine that, right, there was a colorism thing going on. You could only imagine it if they were light-skinned rather than you're staring at a child. And actually, this was horrific.
One of the main goals of that auction for Beecher was to drum up support for the abolition movement. To this day, Beecher is remembered for his outspoken support for abolition. At one point, he was referred to as the most famous man in America. Walt Whitman and Abraham Lincoln traveled to Brooklyn to hear him preach. There's no doubt that he was a staunch and vocal abolitionist and did important work in a turbulent time. But in all the retelling of the history, not much is known about the women and girls who, like Rose Ward, stood next to him at the pulpit awaiting the donations that would purchase their freedom.
But using Brooklyn Public Library's archives, we were able to find out more about Rose Ward. Natiba was able to determine what happened to her after 1860. Rose went on to study at Howard University Normal School and became a teacher. She married a lawyer in Washington, D.C., whose last name was Hunt. She led a satisfying life, says Natiba.
Which is why it was like really important for me to track this story down. And I was kind of happy that she had, you know, what she considered to be a good life. Yeah, so she should not just be a footnote in history. She was so much more.
One of the reasons that we even know what happened to Rose Ward Hunt is that she ended up returning to Brooklyn briefly in 1927. She was 76 years old when the new reverend of Plymouth Church invited her to speak at their 80th anniversary celebration.
And though she accepted the invitation, Rose Ward Hunt was very hesitant.
You know, she's very sort of brief about what she's doing here and sort of her memory of it.
Here's Prithi again, talking about Mrs. Hunt's return to Brooklyn.
This, for me, is the great sort of red flag. She keeps denying her memory of it. She's like, I was so young, I don't remember. And to me, I don't know, this is sort of psychoanalytic babble, but I feel as though there's something so traumatic about it that she's just buried it, and she's not willing to talk about it in public.
The Brooklyn Historical Society has an audio cylinder recording of Rose Ward Hunt from her Brooklyn visit in 1927. It's very grainy and hard to make out since it's almost 100 years old. But with all that has been written about her and said for her, it's about time we listen to Rose herself.
That I greet you and congratulate you upon this your 80th anniversary. I feel it a great privilege to you this day to join you in your celebration and especially to extol the memory of one whose name always seems to me to be the complement of Plymouth Church Brooklyn, the Reverend Henry Ward Beecher.
The fact that we're able to hear Rose in her own words is unusual. We're lucky to be able to follow the trajectory of her life. But Beecher performed these freedom auctions several times with different women and girls from 1848 until 1860. And with the exception of one other story, that of the Edmondson sisters, not much is known about the later lives of these important players in Brooklyn's story of abolition.
So the fact that their story has been forgotten, I think, tells us a lot about the way historical narratives are made, the way the archives are kept, and the way we sort of forget black women or black girls to these historical narratives. So in researching Henry Ward Beecher, not to take away from certainly his radical abolitionism and what he did, but there's so many stories of women like that, and certainly girls and families who are approaching him, but in which if you put the archives together, you can see they've already been fundraising.
As we think about the legacy of slavery 400 years after the first arrival of enslaved Africans in America, it's time to do a better job centering the narratives of Black and African American people in the fight for freedom, right? You know, if Henry Ward Beecher was referred to as the most famous man in America, you know, in part because of his legacy as an abolitionist, there are whole other communities of people who were doing the same thing at the same time that just, you know, their stories aren't common knowledge.
And it's amazing that we have those stories right here in Brooklyn. There were many communities of free black people in Brooklyn before the Civil War. One of the earliest was down by the waterfront in what we now call Dumbo. So this is the early 1800s. It's before Beecher even came onto the scene. And black Brooklynites were already raising funds to purchase freedom for enslaved people and drumming up support for national abolition.
In addition to the active, radical free black community by the waterfront in Brooklyn, there was another neighborhood that was home to another vibrant free black community in what we now know as Crown Heights. At the time, it was called Weeksville.
Krista, I actually got to visit Weeksville Heritage Center recently and talk to some of the people who are responsible for documenting and continuing Weeksville's remarkable story. I got to talk to Alphonse Fabian, a tour educator. It's his job to take visitors into the historic houses at the Heritage Center and tell the story of Weeksville.
You know, I have to confess, I lived in Brooklyn for 6 years before I started working at BPL, and it was only when I started working in Brooklyn that I even heard about Weeksville. So tell me, what was it like to live there?
That's a great question, and it's one that I asked Alphonse, too. Here's what he had to say.
Weeksville was a rural area. And so forth. Not as urbanized as the rest of downtown Brooklyn. I always tell people Weeksville was definitely politically active. So this was just like any other free black settlement. Yes, people going on with their everyday lives. You know, they're working. They're trying to provide for their families. Celebrations, recreational activities. But they're also fighting the good fight. They're fully aware of what's going on, not just in New York City, but what's going on in the rest of the United States.
Around the time of Weeksville's founding, the rest of the United States was engaged in contentious discussions about slavery and black citizenship.
Absolutely. And Weeksville played an important part in agitating for change throughout the 19th century. Many black abolitionists lived in Weeksville or had contacts in Weeksville.
There's the Crager brothers, Peter Crager, Benjamin Crager. There was the Lusters, the Sylvanus Smith. He's one of the founders of Weeksville. And he gave birth to two daughters. So one was a doctor, another one was an educator. So somehow in the 19th century, black Brooklynites were able to balance, you know, having money, providing a living for their family, and at the same time, being abolitionists.
We tend to talk about Weeksville as a free black community because in New York, they were free. But again, there were Southern-born people, which means there were refugees here. There were formerly enslaved people here.
That's Julia Kaiser, the Collections and Archives Coordinator at Weeksville Heritage Center. She pointed out that slavery wasn't just a topic of conversation. It was a real and urgent reality.
Julia also brought out a historical document that shows just how urgent the issue of slavery was for people who lived in Weeksville.
We have an 1860 newspaper. It's printed in the Weekly Anglo-African. And the announcement is aid needed. A meeting was held on the evening of the 22nd at the residence of Mr. Albert J. Storms, Weeksville, to devise a plan for raising means to enable the family of the mother of Mr. Storms to remove from Montgomery, Alabama, to the North at an early day or be sold into slavery.
Wow, that's really powerful. I mean, you know, it's a newspaper ad, but it's actually asking for help for a man to buy his mother out of slavery. And it's illustrating one of the reasons that Weeksville was formed in the first place, right, Adjoa?
Yes, that is one of the questions I asked when I visited. Why was it necessary to form an independent Black community in Brooklyn? Here's how Obden Mondesier put it. He's the oral history project manager at the Weeksville Heritage Center.
Weeksville emerges in 1838 and before the Civil War. And you have to remember there are things that are happening, like the Fugitive Slave Act passes in 1850, mm-hmm. which means that like it's incredibly dangerous to be a free person of color in the United States, just because you have slave catchers going back to places in the North and capturing people, whether they were actually enslaved or not. So being in Brooklyn, which is like a very bucolic and like separate from what is New York, is really helpful for the people living in Weeksville at the time.
So safety was a huge reason, but also political power. At this time in New York, free Black men could vote only if they owned $250 worth of land. Meanwhile, the land-owning requirement for white men had been eliminated. So having jobs and a separate, self-efficient economy was important to gain any sort of voting voice for free Black people in Brooklyn.
And Weeksville was independent in other ways, too, right? There was a successful public school for kids in the neighborhood. There were multiple churches, a cemetery, and even a baseball team called the Weeksville Unknowns. By the time slavery is abolished nationally, the people of Weeksville had decades of practice being free and involved citizens.
But as is the story with so much of Brooklyn, the neighborhood changed. By 1900, new immigrants moved into Weeksville, and descendants of founding Weeksville residents began to move to other parts of Brooklyn or move further upstate.
In the 1940s, the Kingsborough housing projects were built. The neighborhood became known as Crown Heights, and it started to look a lot like what you'll see today. There were shops and brownstones, churches and public schools. Communities with different ethnic backgrounds began to make Crown Heights their home, and Weeksville became absorbed into the rest of Brooklyn.
And it wasn't that people in the neighborhood forgot their past so much. I mean, the churches that had been prominent during Weeksville's heyday survived the neighborhood's changes and continued to celebrate the history of Weeksville. But the story of the vibrant, independent Black community wasn't common knowledge, as you said earlier. That changed in 1968, when a professor at Pratt started to investigate a series of row houses known today as the Hunter Fly Roadhouses.
James Hurley, he was a photographer in the Navy, a pilot photographer, and he linked up with Joseph Haynes, who's also another founder of Weeksville, and they got inside his airplane, and he definitely noticed the difference of the roofing of the houses compared to the other houses in the area.
There are pictures of the houses taken on that first flyover. The Hunter Fly Road houses sit perpendicular to the street, a remnant of the time before Brooklyn's grid system was created. At least a few of the houses were still lived in by the 1960s, but their connection to historic Weeksville wasn't widely known.
People who came here said, oh, I used to hang around these houses all the time. And then you just had some teenagers and some kids who just saw the houses and they just thought, hey, these are just some regular houses. They probably didn't know the significance of it until Project Weeksville, when many of these kids soon became a part of creating that museum.
Project Weeksville had begun. Hurley students and Crown Heights residents, young and old, came together to preserve the history of the neighborhood. There was an archaeological dig, which turned up old photos and documents. Weeksville's rediscovery, for lack of a better word, came at an important time, too. Here's Obden.
So the houses were rediscovered in 1968. You have in Brooklyn a civil rights movement that's very local. Also, as I mentioned before, there's like urban flight. So you have these places that are disinvested. The black community is living here and they're considered invaders of neighborhoods that used to be good. And what this evidence shows with these houses is that they're not invaders, that they've been here just as long as anyone else, and that this is a usable or teachable past.
One of the first things that residents did after discovering the houses was to create a curriculum so that local public schools could tell the story of Weeksville to the next generation.
And that's so important because history only matters as much as you talk about it and teach it. No matter what Crown Heights looks like today and what the demographics of the neighborhood are, the history of a place matters. It's still a teachable past.
Weeksville is a really great example of freed people in a time where people weren't really free. And like that scenario still exists today. You know, the Fugitive Slave Act very much relates to what's happening with ICE. The idea of land ownership very much relates to the issue of gentrification.
And I think it's important to mention that a few months ago, Weeksville Heritage Center nearly had to close its doors because of lack of funding. They put out a call for donations a few weeks before their money ran out. It was nerve-wracking for Weeksville staff, but the call was very successful. Within 6 days, Weeksville reached their funding goal.
But, as Obden pointed out, it's an important reminder that our culture still sidelines African-American history into a separate category.
Black institutions and like black museums have always struggled with finances just because our history isn't as mainstreamed as other places. People don't bat an eye of going to like Williamsburg, Virginia, but like it's an ancillary thought of like, well, let's also go to a black institution. Like we're hopefully getting to the point where like African-American history is synonymous with just American history. And if we're like at that point, or when we get to that point, this will not be an issue.
There has only ever been one book written about Weeksville, which means there's a lot of work to do. For example, we don't know exactly where the founding Weeksville residents came from, where they went. We don't know how the houses were built, and we only know about a few of the businesses that were in Weeksville.
It might seem daunting, but it's also exciting to think about how much more there is to learn. And it's one of the biggest reasons why places like Weeksville have to stay open. We have to keep digging. We have to keep going through the archives. We have to build up the history. And we have to keep the story alive.
All right, now is the time for our book match segment. And here to recommend a few books for you for this episode is librarian June Kofi. Hi, June.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So we've been talking about free black communities in Brooklyn before the Civil War. This year is marking 400 years since enslaved Africans first arrived in America. So we're thinking a lot about the legacy of slavery in this country. And you have put together a list of books and archival materials on that topic, which is exciting. So what's the first thing you've got for us?
Well, the first recommendation I have is a book called Of Cabbages in King County.
Ooh, I see what they did there.
Yes, by Mark Linder and Lawrence Zacharias. And this book is about Brooklyn's agricultural beginnings. Mm-hmm. But what they're also looking at is crucial to that was slave labor.
Right.
And they have interesting statistics. In 1609, there were like a total of 2,013 people and 293 slaves.
In Brooklyn.
In King's County. Yes. And that total number of slaves makes up 15%.
Uh-huh.
By 1749, there was a jump to 34%.
Wow.
Right, so
that's a third of the county.
And this book is just stating that how much slave labor was important to the agricultural community of Brooklyn.
Yeah. Wow, that's fascinating. And what else do you have for us?
It's the first census of the United States.
Oh my gosh, how fascinating.
In 1791. It's just a very thin book. It goes through all of the states. But in New York, they have it, New York broken down into counties. So mm-hmm. they have Kings County. And it's just a little table there that shows the amount of people, but they also have the amount of slaves at that time in 1791.
Yeah, it's part of our legacy here in Brooklyn, too.
Yes.
Thank you so much, June. So for listeners, that was Of Cabbages in Kings County by Mark Linder and Lawrence Zacharias. And then secondly, June is recommending our very slim volume that we have in our archives of the first census of the United States, which was the 1791 census. Yes. So we're going to put a link to the complete book match list on our website, bklynlibrary.org/podcasts. That'll include these titles and also a few more interesting things that June has selected for the episode, and you can check them all out, well, except for that census track that's just likely archival, from Brooklyn Public Library. Thanks, June.
Thank you.
For more stories about Black abolitionists, we've put a link to Priti Kanakamadala's project, In Pursuit of Freedom, on our website. In Pursuit of Freedom debuted in 2014 and was a collaboration between the Brooklyn Historical Society, Weeksville Heritage Center, and the Irondale Ensemble Project.
And we've got two more great things for you to listen to. First, Weeksville Heritage Center has their oral history collection online, and you can listen to all of them at 5thofjuly.org. Also, our friends over at Brooklyn Historical Society have that recording of Rose Ward Hunt's speech at Plymouth Church on their website, and we will have a link for you on our show page.
And you can always visit the Brooklyn Collection Archives at BPL in person or online at bklynlibrary.org/Brooklyn Collections.
Borrowed is brought to you by Brooklyn Public Library and is hosted by me, Krissa Corbett-Kavoris, and Adjoa Aduse. You can find a transcript of this episode at our website.
Borrowed is produced and written by Virginia Marshall with help from Fritzi Bodenheimer and Robin Lester Kenton. Our music composer is Billy Libby.
Borrowed will be back in 2 weeks. Until then, keep fighting the good fight.